offspring, at least if we take Enoch's word for it, because he tells us that when human women became pregnant by the Watchers, they gave birth to great giants, whose height was 3,000 ells, who consumed all the acquisitions of men, and when men could no longer sustain them, the giants turned against them and devoured mankind. 3,000 ells is equivalent to 4,500 feet, or 1,371 meters. Whatever the truth behind this account may be, therefore, it's obvious the angry old shaman is embellishing it fantastically here in his bid to discredit the Watchers. The prospect of human women giving birth to babies who would grow to more than a kilometer in height is patently absurd. Nonetheless, it brings us back to familiar biblical territory again. Indeed, to one of the more notorious passages in the book of Genesis, which reads, "And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown." That's the King James Version, but other translations give the original word Nephilim that the King James Version translates as giants, and we read, "The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were heroes of old, men of renown." So now, further clarity begins to emerge. A group of bad angels, watchers of the heaven, have come to earth, descended specifically on Mount Hermon in Lebanon, transferred some technology, mated with human females, and produced offspring who are in some way gigantic and are called Nephilim. Here's what we're told in the very next verses. "The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord." An amazing amount of credulous nonsense has proliferated around these verses in recent years on the internet, much of it deriving from the late Zechariah Sitchin's science fiction novels, notably the Earth Chronicles series, which he successfully passed off to the public as serious factual studies. I've already touched in chapter 13 on Sitchin's misrepresentations of Baalbek, and while I'm not saying that everything he wrote was fiction, he did throw in some quite valuable and interesting facts. His overall body of work is marred by enough blatant fabrications and fantasy to call for caution rather than immediate trusting acceptance on the part of his readers. His treatment of the subject of the Nephilim is a case in point. Claiming to be an expert in biblical languages, he asked, "What then does the term Nephilim mean?" Stemming from the Semitic root nephil, to be cast down, it means exactly what it says. It means those who were cast down upon earth. The problem, however, as Michael S. Heiser, a genuine biblical scholar and ancient Semitic languages expert, has conclusively demonstrated, is that Sitchin assumes Nephilim to come from the Hebrew word nafal, which usually means to fall. He then forces the meaning to come down onto the word, creating his "to come down from above" translation. In the form we find it in the Hebrew Bible, if the word Nephilim came from the Hebrew Nafal, it would not be spelled as we find it. The form Nephilim cannot mean fallen ones. The spelling would then be Nephulim. Likewise, Nephilim does not mean those who fall or those who fall away. That would be Benophilim. The only way in Hebrew to get Nephilim from Nafal, by the rules of Hebrew morphology, word formation, would be to presume a noun spelt Nafil and then pluralize it. I say presume, since this noun does not exist in biblical Hebrew, unless one counts Genesis 6:4 and Numbers 13:33, the two occurrences of Nephilim. But that would then be assuming what one is trying to prove. However, in Aramaic, the noun Naphilah does exist. It means giant, making it easy to see why the Septuagint, the ancient Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, translated Nephilim as gigantes, giant. Heiser is plainly right about this, because as he points out, there is a later passage in the Old Testament, in Numbers 13, where the word Nephilim appears again. This is thousands of years after the deluge, indeed in the historical period, surely not later than 1200 BC, when the Israelites first entered Canaan after the exodus from Egypt. Advanced scouts report to Moses, "All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them." The context leaves no room for doubt that the Nephilim are people of great size. The references to them as giants in the King James and other versions of the Bible therefore make complete sense, and the translation that Sitchin gives is obviously bogus. Did he know it was bogus, even as he retailed it in his books? There can be no certainty because, as Heiser goes on to prove, Sitchin's grasp of biblical languages was so weak that he was unable to distinguish Aramaic from Hebrew. The notion that the Nephilim were beings who were cast down from heaven, or who came down from heaven, was deployed by Sitchin, Heiser believes, simply because it served his argument and allowed him to make the Nephilim sound like ancient astronauts. Again, the criticism is justified because Sitchin goes beyond what could be an innocent error to give further translations of the word Nephilim that are even more self-serving and phony. For example, he makes them gods of heaven upon earth, and worse still, the people of the rocket ships, an interpretation for which there is no possible justification in any ancient text, but that allows him to speak, amongst other egregious and deceptive fictions, of the aeronautics and space administration of the Nephilim. It is also important, while reviewing this material, which has had such an impact on public perceptions of the past, to be clear that the Watchers, who are never mentioned at all in the Bible, but are said in the Book of Enoch to have descended from heaven, are quite distinct from the Nephilim. There is nothing in the Book of Enoch that says the Nephilim fell or were cast down or came down from heaven in any way. The most we may gather from the Book of Enoch is that the Nephilim are the progeny of the mating of Watchers and human women. But even this is complicated. An authoritative English translation of the Ethiopic text, brought back by Bruce, was made by the Reverend R.H. Charles and first published in 1917. It contains no mention of the Nephilim and describes the Watcher human offspring simply as giants. Likewise, the word Nephilim does not appear in the 1979 translation of Professor Michael A. Nibb, which, as well as the Ethiopic text, takes account of newly discovered Aramaic fragments from the Dead Sea Scrolls. However, a more recent translation by George W. Nicholsberg and James C. Vanderkam, published in 2012, draws on further fragments not considered by Nibb. And here, in chapter 7, verse 2, the word Nephilim appears twice, as follows. "And they, human women, conceived from them, the Watchers, and bore to them great giants, and the giants begot Nephilim, and to the Nephilim were born Eliud, and they were growing in accordance with their greatness." The Nephilim do not appear again in the Nicholsberg and van der Kam translation. Nonetheless, the verse quoted above leaves no room for doubt. They are not to be considered as fallen, or cast down, or any such thing, but as the progeny of Watcher human mating. Nor is it the first generation, the great giants, who are named as Nephilim. It is the second generation, in other words, the offspring of the giants, who are the Nephilim, and they in turn will produce offspring of their own, the Eliud. If nothing else, these Eliud, about whom very little is known outside Jewish mystical traditions, are further evidence of the close genetic relationship between Watchers and humans, so close that they must really be classified as the same species. Generally, when two different species breed, even when they are close enough to produce offspring, such as horses and donkeys, for example, those offspring are themselves sterile. But unlike the sterile mules that result from horse-donkey matings, the Nephilim are clearly not sterile, since they themselves are able to go on to produce offspring, in other words, the Eliud. The only reasonable conclusion, as I've already indicated, is that the Watchers must have been human beings, no doubt surrounded by some aura or glamour to do with their mastery of technology and the sciences, but no more and no less human than the women they mated with, and that therefore their offspring were human too. Quite possibly they were of large stature. Quite possibly the epithet of giants attached to them may also have had something to do with their intellectual abilities, which might have been seen to be superior, but they were human nonetheless, and I see no good reason to conclude otherwise. Meanwhile, because this is a subject around which much confusion swirls, it is necessary to reiterate that there is no suggestion, either in Genesis or in Numbers, the only places they are mentioned in the Bible, that the Nephilim had fallen, even in the metaphorical sense of having sinned. On the contrary, far from being censured, they are described as mighty men of old, heroes, men of renown. Genesis is unequivocal, as the reader can confirm from the passages cited earlier, that it is human wickedness and the evil in human hearts that causes God to send the flood, a cataclysm that is survived not only by Noah's descendants, but by the Nephilim themselves, who were still in Canaan and still of great stature, as the book of Numbers attests, when the Israelites came to take possession of the promised land. Emissaries. After this brief excursion into the foundations of the Sitchin Nephilim cult, let us return to the Watchers and who and what they might be. Enoch's condemnation of them for fornicating with human women finds its counterpart in Genesis, where, though not named, they are clearly the sons of God, who saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Thereafter, the story of exactly what happened is only preserved in Enoch, where we're led to understand that the Watchers taught all unrighteousness on earth and revealed the eternal secrets which were preserved in heaven, which men were striving to learn. Turning now to another of the non-canonical scriptures, the Book of Jubilees, which purports to be a revelation given by God to Moses, we read of the Watchers again, and in a context that brings us back to the Sabians and Haran. According both to the Islamic historian Al-Masudi and the Christian chronicler Gregory Bar Hebraeus, Haran was originally founded by Canaan, the great grandson of Noah. By definition, therefore, though early, Haran is a post-diluvian city. Canaan, sometimes the name is spelled Canaam, was the son of Arabshad. And the son grew, and his father taught him writing, and he went to seek for himself a place where he might seize for himself a city. And he found a writing, which former generations had carved on the rock, and he read what was thereon, and he transcribed it and sinned owing to it, for it contained the teaching of the Watchers, in accordance with which they used to observe the omens of the sun, moon, and stars in all the signs of heaven. Here then is the origin of the star worship of the Sabians, traced all the way back to the mysterious Watchers, whoever they were, whatever they were, who settled in the Near East in antediluvian times, taught our ancestors forbidden knowledge, broke some fundamental commandment by mating with human women, and as a result were remembered as being responsible for the great global cataclysm of the deluge. Were these Watchers the emissaries of a lost civilization of the Ice Age? Perhaps a civilization as far ahead of the Upper Paleolithic hunter-gatherers, who made up the majority of the population of the world at that time, as our own civilization is ahead of uncontacted tribes in the Amazon rainforest today. When I say ahead, I am of course not speaking of moral or spiritual values, but simply of technology, skills, and knowledge. Since such discrepancies still exist in the 21st century, I see no reason in principle why they shouldn't have existed in the remote epoch before the great cataclysms of the Younger Dryas set in between 10,800 BC and 9,600 BC. To continue with this line of speculation, could it be that there was some sort of outreach before those cataclysms? A very careful, considered, structured outreach program to observe, to study, in other words, to watch hunter-gatherer populations, but not to intermingle with them, not to enter into the complicated entanglements of sexual and family relationships with them, and above all, not to transfer any technology to them. One could imagine that a group of anthropologists and scientists sent off to study a previously uncontacted Amazon tribe today might be bound by similar strictures. But suppose some of them disagreed. Suppose some of them went native, as used to be said of colonialists in the days of the British Empire, who allowed themselves to get too close to indigenous populations they interacted with. Is that perhaps what happened to the troop of 200 watchers on Mount Hermon? Somewhere around 10,900 BC, did they break the commandments of their own culture and go native amongst the hunter-gatherers of the Near East? And were the first chance encounters with the fragments of a giant comet a century later in 10,800 BC, encounters that devastated the world, somehow blamed upon their moral lapse? And some final thoughts. Did their civilization survive, albeit in truncated, damaged, reduced form, through the rigors of the Younger Dryas, until the second fateful encounter with the comet's debris stream in 9600 BC that ended the long, fatal winter, but also led to the final sinking and destruction of the homeland of the primeval ones? That island realm, far off in the ocean, that bears such striking resemblances to Plato's description of Atlantis. Was it then that the last survivors of the once advanced and prosperous civilization set out to wander the world in ships to initiate their great design intended ultimately, perhaps after thousands of years, to bring about the resurrection of the former world of the gods? And were Egypt, Baalbek, and Göbekli Tepe amongst the places these magicians of the gods chose to settle in order to set their plan in motion, perhaps precisely because there had been outreach in these areas before the cataclysms, and therefore their potential and the character of their inhabitants were known? Was Haran part of the second stage of this plan, when the work of the last initiates at Göbekli Tepe was done, and the time capsule they had created there was buried to be rediscovered in a future age? Buried in the bowels of the earth, like that white porphyry stone spoken of in the Masonic tradition cited earlier, or like the writing carved on rock containing the teachings of the Watchers, which Kenan found and transcribed at the time he established Haran, bringing into his city knowledge of the omens of the sun, moon, and stars, and all the signs in heaven. Knowledge of exactly the type that would be central to the mysterious star religion of the Sabians in the millennia to come. Astronomy and Earth Measuring. Archaeoastronomer James Q. Jacobs has noticed something rather odd about Haran. The city's latitude, 36.87 degrees north of the equator, appears to be non-random, since the figure is the same as that for the acute angle of a 3-4-5 right triangle, in other words, a triangle which contains one 90-degree right angle and whose side lengths are in the ratio of 3-4-5. In all such triangles, which form the basis for trigonometry and are thus fundamental to astronomy and geodesy, the other two angles are, with rounding, 53.13 degrees and 36.87 degrees. Is it a coincidence that a 3-4-5 right triangle with the same internal angles exists inside the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid of Egypt? The floor of this austere and uninscribed red granite room in which no pharaoh was ever found entombed forms a 2-to-1 rectangle, exactly 20 Egyptian royal cubits in length and 10 royal cubits in width, 10.46 by 5.23 meters. The right triangle is formed with its shortest dimension, 15 cubits, represented by the diagonal across the west wall from the lower southwest corner to the upper northwest corner. Its median dimension, 20 cubits, is drawn along the entire length of the floor on the south side of the chamber. Its long dimension, 25 cubits, is drawn from the upper northwest corner of the chamber to the lower southeast corner. These side lengths of 15 cubits, 20 cubits, and 25 cubits can be expressed as the ratio 3-4-5, because if we allocate the value 3 to the length of 15 cubits, then 20 cubits must naturally have a value of 4, and 25 cubits must have a value of 5. All right-angled triangles with side lengths in this special 3-4-5 ratio are called Pythagorean after Pythagoras, the Greek philosopher and mathematician of the 6th century BC, who was supposedly the first